Hey, it's Callie, and you're listening to the 33rd episode of the Hippie Haven podcast. If you're new here, I release an episode every Wednesday related to living an ethical and eco-friendly lifestyle. Previously, we've covered topics like how to go zero waste, environmental activism, preventing food waste, secondhand shopping, starting an eco-business, and so much more. My goal is to empower you to take action, both in your day-to-day routine and on the larger scale of community activism, because I believe that together we will make a difference in saving the planet. If you haven't already, be sure to hit that subscribe button so that you automatically get each new episode right when it comes out. Today's guest is April Dickinson. You might know her on Instagram as @ZeroWasteDork, and she is the Communications and Operations Coordinator for Washington State Budget and Policy Center, where they work to shape economic policies in Washington that will lift people out of poverty and strengthen communities. April studied law, societies, and justice at the University of Washington and has worked in public policy for over 10 years, two of them as a legislative assistant in the Washington State House of Representatives. In this episode, we're brushing up on how the American government system operates, how bills are introduced and where they go from there, how to find and connect with your state representatives, how to enact change through legislation, plus a ton of other related topics and side conversations. You can find the show notes and transcript for this episode on my website at ahippieinavan.com/033. This episode is sponsored by my zero waste company, Bestowed Essentials. We have an online shop and a retail location in Rapid City, South Dakota, where we offer a curated collection of ethical and eco-friendly home goods. Everything from beauty products to oral care to dish soap to produce bags and more. Over 80% of our products are handmade in the U.S. by female-owned small businesses, and everything is 100% natural, vegan, and cruelty-free. We package and ship all orders with no plastic, and you can save 10% off your order with code HIPPIEHAVEN10. What's your background in politics?
So I was a legislative assistant to a state-level representative, and that just means that I was this person's primary staff person. And that was my second job out of college. And then after working in the state legislature, I also worked in child health policy for a nonprofit health plan. And then now I'm working for Washington State Budget and Policy Center. And we're a organization that works to bring economic policies that lift up people with low and moderate incomes. So I've been in public policy now for about a little over 10 years.
So give us a basic refresher of the American government system and specifically how the legislative branch works.
Yeah, I think it's good to remember that there's a lot of different things at play at any given time. So we have the executive branch where the president and his staff get to have some influence on public policy, and then the judicial branch with the Supreme Court and other federal courts that also have an impact. And then probably the branch that we deal with most, the legislative branch, is Congress. And in Congress, you have the Senate and the House. This is the same in most state level governments as well. And the legislative branch, like I said, it's made up of the Senate and House. And so in our system, it's kind of hard for me to talk about Congress with any sort of straight face because they're so ineffective right now. There's just a lot of infighting within parties and then fighting between parties, and a lot of there's just a lot of what seems like sound bites, but not a ton of work happening on the ground. So it's hard to sometimes track what they're even trying to do there. But that's where you're supposed to pass laws that affect everyone in the country.
In the legislative branch with the state House and Senate, or at the federal level, what are bills and what's the process that they go through?
Yeah, so a bill is basically something that has been drafted up by policymakers or policy staff at different organizations. And it is usually stemming from some part of the Constitution or law that's already on the books, and it's adjusting it. Usually it's a law that's adjusting something that's already on the books. And the bills are championed by a member of either the Senate or the House. And they have to go through a pretty lengthy process to actually get passed. And this is true at both the state and federal level. There are multiple committees within each of the branches of the legislature, and each of those committees has, again, people kind of with different interests on either side of the bill. And then there's another caveat of whether or not the bill costs money. So if your bill that you're trying to pass might require some state funding or federal funding, then it goes through a whole nother process. But they need to basically go through the committee that is the one that has the subject matter experts on the bill that you're trying to pass. Once it's passed through that committee, it'll go to, it'll go from the House side over to the Senate side and vice versa. There's a whole level of leadership that has to pass the bill. And then, let me rephrase that. After it passes from the House side to the Senate side or vice versa, then the bill has to go through the same process over again. It needs to go through the committees with the appropriate people to look at it, and then has to be passed by the entire House again, either the House or the Senate. Then it goes back to the originating side. So if the bill started out as a House bill, it has to go back to the House again and be approved. And then finally, it can be passed. So there's all these steps along the way, which makes it, I think, sometimes really hard for an average person to really follow along and know what all of the different steps are and where you can have an effective voice for change or for to support the bill or even to oppose it, which is really important, which is makes it really even more important to engage with organizations that know the ins and outs of how the process works and who know the different players. It's important to know the chairs of the different committees, who are the lead people in leadership, and where their interests lie and how strong relationship they have with the different advocates. I call lobbyists who are wearing the white hats, I call the good lobbyists advocates. Most lobbyists are actually okay, but you want to know who those people are because they're going to really help shepherd along a bill from the start of a very lengthy process to the very end.
And so to clarify, when you said earlier that the bill has to be championed, that means the bill has to be introduced by one of the representatives, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And there's several deadlines that have to be met to do that. One representative or senator will kind of, they'll be the prime sponsor of a bill. In Washington state, they're called prime sponsors. And then before a bill is introduced, oftentimes that particular legislator will go to different other legislators in their, in their committees or just the people that they have close relationships with who they think will support the bill and will add them on as co-sponsors. But yeah, the bill has to be introduced first, and there's a certain cutoff. If you don't introduce it by a certain period of time, then you just can't even start with that bill.
And that would be until the next legislative session the following year, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And to get really, really basic for a second, so representatives are your Congress people in the House, and senators are the ones in the Senate, and then either groupings can be called like congressman or woman, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
At the federal level, that's correct.
What is it at the state level? What's the difference?
So the state, every state is a little bit different. For instance, in New York, there it's called a state assembly. So you have like assembly members, and I don't get their system, so I won't explain it. But in Washington, we have the same terminology, senators and representatives, but they would just be called like state legislators. And there's always, in both the federal level and in the state level, you generally have two representatives for every district and then only one senator. At the congressional level, it's different. Like, you know, we get two senators per state at the congressional level and then several more representatives based on the population of your state. And every state might run their local government slightly differently, but it generally follows that rule.
And what are lobbyists?
So lobbyists are basically people who are I always stumble to describe lobbyists because they get such a bad rap, but really they're not all bad people. They are typically people who are just very well versed in policy and in how policy works, who have a really detailed understanding of the subject matter, and how to get a bill passed. So, at the congressional level, I think lobbyists, you tend to hear about them representing large interests like pharmaceutical industry, oil and gas industry, but there's also a ton of lobbyists that work for really amazing organizations, that are fighting for food justice, that are really working towards, like changing our criminal justice system to be more reflective of, you know, what the, you know, what citizens want. And, you know, but they're all called lobbyists, so they all kind of get lumped into this kind of bad framing. But essentially, they're just subject matter experts, and they're the ones that are really going to be able to be in the state capitals or at in Washington, D.C., on the ground, meeting with legislators and other policymakers. Besides legislators, too, there's staff people are really, really involved in how the bills get through the system. And lobbyists are able to connect with staff and make sure that the bill language isn't changing too much, or making sure that the staff people bring the appropriate level of attention to the legislators. So I would say the lobbyist really is like a conduit between the average citizen and the systems that are in place, whether it be Congress or a state level legislature.
So when a bill is moving up through both sides of Congress or the assembly, and it has to go through these different committees, what are some of the ways that the opposing party can kind of purposely mess up the bill's progress? And how often do you see that happening?
Yeah, actually, we've experienced some of that recently in our legislative advocacy this year at the current organization I work for. One of the really great ways that the opposing side can mess up your bill is add an amendment to it. And amendments can be added through various ways. I won't really get into that, but if the Democrats are chairing or have a majority in a committee, and the Republicans kind of feel like, well, they have the upper hand because they just have more votes, they might try to steamroll the bill by adding an amendment that renders it basically ineffective. And it happens all the time. And it happens to the extent where if the amendment gets approved, the advocates who were pushing the bill might give up on it entirely. So there's a lot of, that's definitely like the politics happening at the legislative level at both the state level, and the federal level. Parties are really just grappling for power and control. And so I'll just explain, like for Washington, we have a majority of Democrats in our state, which means that pretty much every committee has a Democratic chair and then a Republican vice chair of the committee. But it just gives a little bit more control to the Democrats. You see the same thing in Congress, right? So when the Democrats are in control, the Speaker of the House gets to be a Democrat. And all of the fighting back and forth over policy is really about who has control over making these decisions. And it can really, really, dishearten people who are fighting for, you know, like for us, we fight for low-income people who are just trying to get by. They're just trying to get their basic needs met. And then you see people who have no clue what it's like to struggle to pay a phone bill, deciding whether or not they're going to give food assistance to a certain group of people.
I've heard a lot of people that say, you know, oh, I just don't really care very much about politics, or, you know, politics, they don't really affect me, or I just don't really like to get into politics. But I think politics really do affect every single one of us every single day in so many little ways that we don't even think of. And so what are some of your thoughts on that for people who just don't care about politics?
I think that you're absolutely right. Politics affect us every single day in even the most mundane ways. I think that what people don't like is kind of the back and forth. They don't like to see the fighting. They don't like to see, politicians grandstanding. But even if maybe the politics themselves, like, you know, using air quotes, right? Like, even if the politics maybe don't affect you, politicians are helping to form the laws that we're all bound by and are making decisions that affect us every single day. Where, like, you know, Detroit is a great example, where the water source came from for an entire community of people was decided upon by the city council. And by people not caring, Flint is still without clean drinking water. And, you know, the way that traffic laws are decided happen often at the local level. Not, you know, it's not Congress, right? And I think that we oftentimes get wrapped up too in these like really high level values conversations at the federal level. And those have some bearing on our daily lives, but the things that are really affecting us are happening at the local level. So city councils, county councils, and the state legislature. If you're not paying attention to what's happening there, you're really letting other people decide for you how your community is structured, what gets invested in. I mean, even something as basic as whether or not a certain pothole gets filled. I mean, that happens at a committee in a city government. So if you're driving along your street and you really don't like that pothole, time to get involved, you know? And one thing that's really been contested in Washington State is school funding. We have it's very difficult to fund our schools properly because of the way that we do it. And so if people don't speak up about what they're willing to do, how they're willing to change, and what types of policies they're willing to accept, then we're just going to let other people decide for us. And then our kids have to deal with those consequences. So I think sometimes it would be good to just kind of step back from the federal debates every once in a while and, you know, take a look what's on the agenda at the city council this week. Take a peek, because you might be surprised about what they're discussing.
Yeah, I think apathy is a privilege, and it's one that we definitely can't afford anymore, because these little tiny things really do affect every single one of us every day.
And sometimes they have really dire consequences, like in Flint, or, you know, deciding not to do certain repairs. In Washington, we had a bridge collapse, and that was, you know, devastating. People lost lives, and people lost livelihoods because that part of the interstate wasn't, you know, you couldn't travel it really anymore. It's these types of decisions at the local level are really having important impacts on people. And yeah, you're right. It is a privilege to not care. If your life is not affected by anything that happens at the legislative level, count yourself lucky. There are people in Congress right now fighting about whether or not people deserve to get access to food. The farm bill is being, you know, discussed right now, and part of it is food assistance, so SNAP and WIC. And, you know, again, like, I don't like to really talk about the federal level, but that affects your neighbor. In the school system that my son goes to, and I've talked about this on my Instagram, his school has, you know, I help out with the, every Friday we send kids home with food that we've collected from the food bank. And, for me, you know, it's easy for me to complain about like not having access to bulk food stores or whatever. I never complain about that, 'cause I actually have too much access to bulk food stores, but I see that a lot in the zero waste community. And while we're complaining about that and plastic packaging, there are families who rely on a free meal at school to feed their children. And during the weekends, they're not necessarily sure where that food's going to come from. So, you know, we set up packages of food for them, And our school has about 48 kids participating in that program, but two other neighboring schools have over 100 kids in each school who rely on that program for food over the weekend. And so, you know, these are things that are happening in your communities. You might not be aware, but it's definitely happening, and we should start banding together more to protect, you know, the very basic needs of our communities.
In Washington State, what are some of the current bills that you have your eye on?
So Washington State is actually proposing a reusable bag bill, and this would be a statewide bill. Finally, we have, over the years, I think it's like over the last 6 to 7 years, different cities have proposed bag bans and plastic bag bans, and they all have slightly different policies around that. Some of them are only for grocery stores. Some of them are for all food takeaway stores. Some of them charge a 5-cent fee to use a bag, some a 10-cent fee. So right now at the state level, there is a proposal for a statewide bag ban that would charge, it would ban all thin plastic bags at every retail establishment and charge a 10-cent fee for a bag. And the bags that would be available from the store are paper or like one of those thick plastic bags that can technically be reused. And right now, it looks like the status of this bill is to, there is a House version of the bill and a Senate version of the bill. And that one actually looks like it might pass, which is great. There's another bill that's really interesting, and it's about plastic package stewardship. And this bill basically would be a model like similar to more European countries or cities where they require the manufacturer to pay for the recovery of the plastic. So basically, they would charge like a small fee to purchase the item that's in plastic. And then, let me get this right. So it says that it's similar to programs in place in the EU and in British Columbia, and at the end of life of all the plastic packaging would be responsibly managed. And when they say managed, it means by the manufacturers. So it's a stewardship program paid for by the plastic packaging manufacturers. And it would remove any, I said that it would charge the consumer a fee, but I think my understanding actually is that it would remove any fees for consumers and put it directly onto the manufacturers. As you can imagine, this bill is facing a lot of opposition and most likely will not make it out of the legislature this year. But one of the things that so I found out about this bill from a group called Zero Waste Washington, and they do all kinds of policy related work on anything that has to do with materials in Washington, material disposal. And they asked us to support this bill, even if it doesn't go out of committee, because they want to show legislators that constituents in Washington care about this and want this. So even if there's not really the political will right now for something like this, it will help send the signals to the legislature that next year we're going to try again and we're only going to build more support. So when it comes around again, it won't be new. It'll be they will have already heard about it, and it makes it just a little bit easier the next year and the next time around to try again.
My thought with that, when you said that it'll have to be responsibly managed by the manufacturers, is if there's going to be any oversight to make sure that it's actually being responsibly managed or not.
What's interesting about that is I Quit Waste on Instagram. She posted a graphic recently about the percentage of all of the plastic that goes to Indonesia and where, like the percentage of where it comes from. And the number one country was the United States. The second was Japan. And the third was Germany. And I was really shocked by that because like, I know that our recycling system sucks, but I thought that Japan and Germany were always really proud of their recycling system, but they're just sending it to Indonesia. So I don't know if that's considered responsible or not. And I have to say, I was a little bit disappointed in some of these bills when I heard about them, because they're not eliminating plastic at all. And the thicker bags are going to require a lot more plastic to make. They will take much longer to break down, and they'll only be reused if we have a culture of reusability. And I just don't know if we're there yet, if we keep giving people disposable options or seemingly disposable options. And then same with the plastic package stewardship. It's not saying that we don't want plastic anymore. It's just saying that we want the manufacturers to handle it. And I'm not, at first I was like, oh, okay, cool. It'll be like those European models. Great. But
no, I don't trust them.
Yeah. I'm just like, oh, oops. Like, it's so easy for us, because we have this system right now of it goes away and I don't have to think about it. And you can tell me it's responsible and I'll believe you because I don't have to deal with it. And so it makes us feel like, you know, it's like wish cycling, right? We just have hope and we just have faith that the system's going to work. But so far we've been shown time and time again that the system is so broken that I just want a whole new system altogether.
Agreed. And as you were talking about those two bills, I was jotting stuff down to come back to. And one of them, my note says, thick plastic worse if not reused, when you were talking about that first bill.
Right. Exactly.
Well, okay. So a quick question for you. You mentioned with that first bill that there was a House version and a Senate version. Why are there two different versions? Is that normal?
That is normal. And usually it's because whoever was the sponsor of the bill had slightly different ideas of either how to implement it, how to word it, or where in the state code it should be. And so each bill, they're called companion bills because they're usually fairly similar. But I think it's always kind of important to keep in mind, these are all humans that are trying to do this. And humans are not straightforward, and we have all different kinds of aspirations about what we want to do, and that gets imprinted into this legislation, the will and desires of each individual legislator that happens to be involved. So I'm looking at the bill numbers right now, for instance, and the reusable bag bill is, you know, House Bill 1205, and then it's substitute Senate Bill 5323. So already at some point in the process, they had to replace some language and now create a substitute bill. So yeah, it's really complicated. Nothing ever goes in a straight line. Very, very rarely. Maybe if you've been at the same bill for like 10 years and it's already been changed a bunch of times, can you get it through in a pretty straight line the next time you try? But the process is always very circuitous. It's always being bent to the will of who's looking at it and taking interest in it. And so it's good to kind of keep track when you see that substitute come in to the language of the bill. You should open up the bill and see what was changed, because they'll strike out the old language and add the new one in there. And you can decide whether or not you like that change or not. And that's kind of where I was saying before too, about sometimes a bill gets so muddied down by different people putting their thoughts and opinions on it that it's not really this original bill that you wanted, and you might not even want to support it anymore.
So my last note with these two bills that you mentioned, with the bag ban in particular, so I'm actually going to be recording an episode tomorrow with somebody who successfully implemented a plastic bag ban in her local city, and how she did it and how other people can do that. And so I'm planning to schedule this episode with you and her episode back to back. So yeah, that'll be something. So it'll either have already come out or it'll come out after yours. But that's something that people can listen to as well. So my next question is, what are your personal thoughts on the Green New Deal?
Well, it would be very unlike me to have no thoughts. So I think that the Green New Deal is, well, on first reflection, I thought it was great. I thought it was definitely what we needed. A transition to renewable energy with a just, or a, excuse me, a just transition to a renewable energy economy sounds great. We want to make sure that people aren't left behind when we propose new legislation, when we think of a new way to organize our country and how we power our country. But one thing I'm really concerned about is I saw an article that featured Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she said that this bill will be paid for through economic growth. And I just feel like climate change activism and economic growth don't go together. Unless you mean growth in only certain sectors while other sectors experience a decline. So I don't know all the details of the bill, but I just worry that the approach isn't really holistic and that different communities have not necessarily participated in the drafting of the bill, and that we're just going for the kind of high level, what are those cool talking points that I want to hear? Like, I absolutely want to hear just transition. That's super important to me. But if it hasn't been well thought out and we don't really know how we're going to do it, then the transition won't be just. People will be left behind. And when the and one thing that was also really disconcerting to me is that AOC, when she was talking, she was doing a press conference, and she's a really strong, powerful woman of color, and I'm really glad that she's in Congress because everyone who was behind her was a white male. And nothing against white males, but we need to have more diverse representation. So I was like, well, who else is at the table then? She can't do it alone. She needs more people to be involved. And I really hope that she would involve community members who are on the ground, who know how this work has been played out in their communities. And I just don't know that anything in Congress is really going to help us. I think that there's already so many things happening on the ground that we can support and move forward on that I'm not really sure something like the Green New Deal has to be our saving grace. I don't want it to take attention away from local things that are happening, because I think investment can start at the local level and grow out, and it doesn't have to be so top down. And just the environment in Congress being as contested as it is, I'm not sure I want any of those people to take the credit for her like succeeding in this movement either. There was this really interesting interaction that happened where the Sunrise Movement activists went to Dianne Feinstein's office and were basically trying to tell her about the Green New Deal, ask her to support it in a very, intense way. And, Feinstein basically shouted them down, saying, "I've been doing this for 30 years. I got elected. I know what I'm doing," I think is one of the quotes from her. And if she's been at it for 30 years, same with the other people who have been in Congress so far, decades long, 20, 30, some 40 years, and we are even closer to catastrophe than before, you're not doing it right. So move along. Let these new young thinkers take the lead, listen to what they're saying, and maybe we'll get somewhere. But like Dianne Feinstein's response to me was such a good example of the fact that it's a white supremacist institution with people who want to hold on to power, and they are not really listening to what we need and what we want. We're going to have, I think, more success at the state and citywide levels. I'll just provide a couple of examples of things I heard about recently through social media that I think are really inspiring. In Atlanta, they and again, this is kind of one of those nuances where I'm not sure if it's totally passed yet, but in Atlanta, the city's utilities committee just passed a bill unanimously to provide Atlanta with 100% renewable energy by 2035.
And oh, I just saw that today. That's so exciting.
That's amazing. And, you know, that didn't need the Green New Deal. That was Atlanta deciding unanimously too, which is, that's amazing. And then in Oxford, Ohio, this is from Zero Waste Fail. The previous stat I saw from Beyond Zero Waste. But Zero Waste Fail had this really great post where she talked about how her and her family and other community members lobbied their city council for, you know, they went to multiple meetings. I think she said like five or more meetings. And at the end of their advocacy, their city passed a carbon fee and dividend policy. And so, you know, that's some, those are things that are happening now that are happening in, you know, Atlanta's a pretty big city, but like Oxford, Ohio is probably not a huge city. And I just think that there's so much that we can really show up for in our communities that are doing the jobs now that the new Green Deal or that the Green New Deal promises to do that I'm just not sure is going to happen. I think we should still support it, absolutely, but ask critical questions, make sure to connect our representatives with local resources that they can partner with to make sure it's successful, and to make sure that we are always considering who could possibly be left behind if we don't consider, you know, low-income communities or indigenous communities. You know, there's a lot of leadership already on the ground that we should tap into.
Well, I think you actually just answered my next question then of where is the best way to start in enacting change in your community. And so I think with what you said of finding the groups that are already on the ground and tapping into those resources, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much expertise already around us. And people who are really doing the hard work, you know, they're really putting the labor and the love into it. I think that, you know, democracy and stuff is important, right? Like we need to have people representing us, in our legal systems, but they can get out of touch very quickly. So it's important to kind of step back and look around and see who's really doing the work, who has the local expertise, and how can I support what they're doing? And sometimes it means, you know, not just their actual day-to-day work, but maybe they have some bills that they're trying to get through either the city, county, or state level that you could support, that you could talk to your friends about, or that you could call your legislators and representatives about. So I'm always really inspired by what's happening around us in Seattle and in just across the state.
So how can people who live in rural areas far away from the state capital or from these existing groups and organizations, how can they still connect with their state legislators and enact change?
So there's a couple ways to do it. In every system, you have, let's see, how do I want to say this? There's two ways I think that people in rural communities can connect with their legislators and be effective. And one is to wait until the legislative session is over, or when the legislature is not in session, your representative should be relatively close to your neighborhood. Representatives have to come from geographical areas that span across the state. And with our congressional leaders, they have to have offices that are also spread out throughout the state. So if there is a local office that is closer to you, I highly, highly recommend being a former legislative assistant. I highly recommend calling the office and setting up a meeting. It is their job to go to meetings. Like that's all they do. Meetings every day, all day. And so you might as well be one of those meetings. The meetings usually aren't very long, 30 minutes probably during the interim, so not during session, and then 15 minutes during session. So if you're meeting with your legislator in person, just be very clear on what it is you care about, what you're passionate about, and what your legislator can do about it. So be very specific about your ask. Do you want them to oppose something? Do you want them to support something? Maybe you've got a report and you just want them to read about it. Just be really clear about what it is that you want for them to do. During the legislative session, getting to the state capitol can be hard. So just pick up the phone and call the office. I'm always happy to speak to someone who's not a lobbyist. I was very happy to speak with just a constituent who cared. And if I didn't answer the phone, I would always return a call. So that's another great way where it doesn't take a lot of time, maybe 2 to 3 minutes, 5 minutes tops. You'll get to speak to someone who wants to help you, who wants to spread your message. And it's a great way to connect with your legislator's office during the session.
Now, what about people who are physically unable to get to meet with their legislators in person, or say they're really introverted, or there's some other type of limitation or accessibility issue where that's just not an option? What are other opportunities available?
So if you're able to writing a letter and sending it in the mail is actually great. It's a great way to get the legislator's attention. We don't get a ton of like unique letters, at least back when I was working as a legislative assistant, that was pretty uncommon. And I would always try to write a letter back. If you're going to write an email and that is easy for you, just make sure that your email has a unique subject line. One thing that happens when you send a form email to a representative is on the receiving end. So what I would see in the inbox are like 25 emails that have the exact same subject line. I typically would scan those for any personal comments. If an email had a personal comment, then I would write back with our official statement. If it didn't, then I would just tally it. And that's how our office worked. Every office works a little bit different, but, you know, during sessions, there's just not enough time to answer every single email. So if you really want to engage with your legislator's office, I suggest just writing a completely unique email that simply states, again, that simply states what your request is, what the bill is, what the bill number is, and what you want your legislator to do, support it or not. And then add a sentence or two of why it's personally important to you. That really helps us, you know, humanize the whole process. If you're a person who has a disability, whether physical or we had some advocates come to us who used wheelchairs and who used voice recognition software, and they were able to come to Olympia and see us because they worked closely with their service organizations. So for anyone who might have even like vision impairments or something like that, I know that in Washington State, there are a lot of service organizations that work together with advocates of varying ability levels and help them engage with their legislators in a way that's comfortable to them. And it was always really cool for us to see that, you know, to see that extra level engagement and that extra effort that came with bringing together a group of people who maybe would not normally have access.
And how do you go about finding out who your representative is and like what their phone number is, their email address, where their local office is? Where is all that information?
So again, every state is a little bit different. If you just do a Google search, or in my case, I don't use Google anymore. I use Ecosia, do an Ecosia search. You'll be able to find all that information. They have to make it public and they have to make it easily accessible. And in Washington, our legislature's web address is leg.wa.gov. And you can type in your zip code and it will tell you who your senator and two representatives are. And it will give you all of the contact information that you need.
Okay, so quick shout out to Ecosia. Why is it that you use them and not Google? Because I know what you're talking about, but I'm sure a lot of people don't. And so if you just want to like promo them for a second.
Yeah, Ecosia is a alternate search engine that you can use. And it is basically for every search that you make using their platform, they will plant a tree. So I think right now they're up to like 50 million trees that they have banked up to plant. And I feel like they're very transparent. They show you the projects that they're working on. They show you the transformations that have taken place so far. And one thing, the main reason why I go with them is that, like, when you enter in a search query, it doesn't track your information, which is both a good and bad thing. You know, once it starts tracking you, you know, the systems tend to get better or whatever. But so sometimes the searches are a little bit harder because it's not like there's not a lot of AI going on in there. But I just prefer going with a search engine that's not tracking every single thing I do, and that provides a public good like planting trees. And the other great thing too is they work with local tree planting communities. So all of the plants are native plants, and they're working with people who have already established a tree planting system. So it's kind of just bolstering those operations that already exist.
And I'll add a link to them in the show notes too, because they're really cool and people should check them out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So back to contacting your representatives, you mentioned that like if you're emailing or sending a letter or whatnot, you want to make sure that you're referencing the bill number and whether or not you're encouraging them to support or oppose it and add some sort of like personal humanized touch to it. What other tips do you have for making sure that when you're trying to contact your representatives that your voice is actually being heard?
Again, I would go back to just a phone call. That's really how you know you talk to somebody in the office, and you're not you're very rarely going to talk to the actual legislator, but talking to their staff, I think, is really important. And maybe I just feel that way because I was a staff person, but the staff people are working with the legislator side by side. And if you can build a connection with that staff person, so if you, you know, call them more than once, and can start to build a relationship, then the staff person will remember you and they'll be able to think of you when it's time to discuss that particular topic with the legislator. So I really think that that's important. It adds that personal touch. I know that sometimes, you know, I couldn't answer the phone or whatever. The other ways I just don't think are that effective. I think the other way that you could possibly make your voice heard that I haven't discussed yet is to join a lobby day. In Washington, they're called lobby days. I'm not totally sure if other states have different ways of calling them, but
you're talking about like town halls?
Town halls are another way to go and possibly have your voice be heard. Town halls can be tough because there's limited times for questions, but those are great opportunities to get some face time. I'm referring to what we call lobby days is when an organization will basically host an event in Olympia for their members where they set up all of the meetings for your legislators for you. So an example might be the environmental lobby day. So you would sign up to attend the lobby day and provide your address so that the staff people of this organization can set up meetings for a group of people. So you plus upwards of like 5 to 10 people would go and meet with your legislator. You would tell them what the legislative priorities of the environmental organization is, and you would have a chance to ask them questions. And that's a really great way also to get face time where you don't have to do the legwork to set up the appointments, and you get to meet each of your legislators in the same day. So it helps kind of make the process a little bit more efficient.
So I know I personally, I hate making phone calls. And so when I do call my state or federal representatives, I oftentimes will do it with a script and I'll customize it and whatnot. But it makes it easier for me to make that phone call and to feel comfortable and not have my voice be all shaky and hesitant and like, why am I calling kind of thing. In your experience, when people call with scripts, is that seen as valid or is that not taken as seriously?
I think it depends on the issue. Normally, we would only get a bunch of calls with a script if it's an issue that we're kind of already aware of and we're basically just taking a tally. And oftentimes that tally is either used by the representative to kind of maybe give a speech in a committee or on the floor saying, you know, I had hundreds of constituents call me about this, so I know that it's important and we should pass it. So I think adding your call to that tally is a good thing to do. But in terms of like really hearing what you're saying, it maybe gets a little bit like dampened down just by the sheer volume of calls. And sometimes like you can kind of tell someone's reading from a script, and that's totally okay. What you might do to try to get over those jitters is maybe just ask a question at the end. A lot of times the scripts that we get, or the types of calls that we get that have scripts, will end with, you know, "And I want you to support this bill. Thank you." And it's really just a statement. And so I will just say, "Thank you for your call. I've registered your support. You know, have a nice day." But if you end your script with a question, that's going to require the staff person to kind of step out of their, you know, kind of to think more a little bit about what you're saying and provide a more detailed response, and maybe even bring more attention to what it is that you're calling about. And maybe the staff person doesn't know the answer, so they would have to ask the legislator or ask other staff people, which will also give the issue that you're calling about a little bit more amplification instead of getting kind of drowned out by all the other people calling about the same thing and saying the same thing.
And so what was it like to work as an assistant for a state rep?
I loved it. It was really exciting. And I mean, building a relationship with the legislator was definitely my favorite part. Our values really aligned, so that was really great. But honestly, my favorite thing was hearing from and interacting with constituents. It was the best part of my job. Whether somebody came to the office in Olympia or just called me when I was scheduling meetings for my boss, being able to talk to people that are in our that were in our district and who really cared about what was happening, it was really rewarding. The one drawback was you kind of get to see the way that things operate behind the scenes. So I was, you know, it was my second job out of college, and I was very idealistic about what a representative government meant. And then I got to Olympia and saw that it doesn't really go that way. So maybe, you know, one thing to kind of keep in mind is that a lot of things are decided by the people who are in charge. And, you know, that's the system that we have now. I wish it were different. And I wish that only the good bills got passed, but that's really not how it works. Everyone who goes to Olympia to be a representative, I think, really does want to do a good job and represent the interests of their constituents. But then they are just bound by this system that wants to keep certain powers in place. And that's actually one of the reasons why I left, is because I just got a little bit jaded, I guess, and wanted to feel like I had a little bit more impact. But I don't say that to be discouraging. I do say that so that people understand that, you know, just because you care about a bill and think it's an amazing bill doesn't mean that it's going to go through and that it's that easy. There's a lot of barriers in the way that we have to understand are there in order to overcome them. And the more that we work together on that and engage with communities that are, you know, doing this work day in and day out, the more success we will see in the future. So, and knowing that, like, if your bill, it didn't make it through a committee, that it's dead, you know, so you don't need to keep advocating for that bill. You need to strategize on how to make that bill successful the next year. So that's another way that we can be more productive too, is to understand how the process works and know who the players are who can really help us get us over these barriers the next time around. But it's fascinating, and I recommend that everyone go and visit their state capital or their city council and just take a look and see what's going on. I think people really take for granted that there's really important conversations happening inside marbled walls, you know?
What social media accounts do you personally recommend we should all be following to stay up to date on state and federal politics?
So at the national level, I'm really enjoying Sunrise Movement. They are really active and really being creative in how they're doing their advocacy. 350.org has been around for a while, and they're really good about being up to date on legislation and kind of what's happening. And then Citizens Climate Lobby is also, so they're a federal group that has many local branches. And actually, for all of these groups, they all lobby at the federal level, but have local branches that you can engage with. I really like how Citizens Climate Lobby, I joined their mailing list, I think, and then somebody called me like 2 weeks later and was just like, "Hey, we saw that you signed up. Do you have any questions? Do you want to join our meeting that's next week?" And they really provided that personal touch and personal outreach. So I highly recommend them. For Washington, I recommend that people check into Zero Waste Washington, because they're really super smart when it comes to policy, and they really know how the process works. And they've been working really hard across the state to pass all these like plastic bag ban bills. I don't think they are active on Instagram, but they're active on Facebook, and we'll be able to provide you a lot of information there. And then Cascadia Climate Action is another local one, where even just today they did a panel with some local experts on legislation, or the lawsuit between the 21 children and the federal government about climate change. And they do a lot of local events to try to keep people informed, which I think is just a really great way to not only learn more about legislation, but connect with other people around you that care and really get that sense of community.
Now, my last question is going to go completely off topic from politics.
Okay.
But you are, of course, you're on Instagram at Zero Waste Dork, and you were the one who came up with the hashtag Zero Waste IRL, correct?
That's right.
So what is your number one tip for living an ethical and eco-friendly lifestyle, especially coming from the perspective as the only zero waster in your household?
I think that for me lately, it's just been like, I really take to heart the refuse when it comes to the like five R's of zero waste. Refuse, reduce, reuse, recycle, rot. Oh my God. How many did I don't even know if I said five, but whatever. The refuse one for me is the most important one, because, it has completely changed how I approach everything. I used to, you know, like wander around stores just to look for something to buy. I don't know why. I don't even know where half that shit is anymore. I'm just like drowning in it now, trying to declutter. And I'm like, oh, you know, I don't have to do that anymore. And so it's really helped me reframe how I just like live my daily life. I also just like, I rarely even ever take out my debit card anymore. And I know exactly what I need to buy, which is mostly food. I will definitely buy food. I'm not opposed to that. but I'm also like very mindful of that too. I think that our number one problem isn't so much that things are individually packaged or that there's plastic around us. It's that we are kind of, we're given messages that we need to consume to appear successful, whether that's, you know, federal GDP or whether that's just for your household. If we consume and if we have material goods, that means that we're doing well in life. And that's really where I think a lot of the problems stem. And so if we can just stop and reassess what our actual needs are and what really brings us joy, then I think we can live a lot more ethically and sustainably. And I'll just give one example, like palm oil. Palm oil, when it wasn't being exploited and there wasn't such a high demand, it was a perfectly sustainable crop. But because of overconsumption of palm oil, that's what's actually driving the like destruction of the rainforests in Indonesia and making a perfectly viable product completely unsustainable. So if we don't take a step back to really address our consumption habits, none of the packaging matters, in my opinion. You know, it's like there's probably a bunch of other things that we could do too, but if we don't really look at it from that very foundational level of how much of a thing we're using and why, I think it really can make it difficult to feel like you're having an impact. So that's been my biggest lesson too. It's been a big learning lesson just to self-reflect on that and to try and really change that in myself and to help steer my family towards it a little bit too.
And that's a wrap. In next week's episode, I'll be chatting with a woman in South Carolina who successfully got her city council to implement a plastic bag ban, and she'll be sharing how you can do the same in your town. If you find value in this Hippie Haven podcast, please share it with someone you know who'd be interested and post about it on social media. If you're on Instagram, don't forget to tag me too. I'm at a hippie in a van. Please also leave a review in iTunes or whichever podcast app you're using. It takes only 60 seconds and it helps boost the visibility of this podcast to more people. Plus, it makes me really happy to read your reviews. Thank you all from the bottom of my heart for spending this time with me. I hope you have a great rest of your day.